Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 47. On this episode, we're talking about Into the Woods, a classic stage play brought to the silver screen. And to help me talk about it is a first-time guest, Ethan Roberts, great guy, theater teacher, so he's going to know what he's talking about, and Laura, who most of you are familiar with. In this episode, we're talking about a great many things, including wishing your life away, not knowing what we want in life. We talk about the heart of a fairy tale and everyone's own last midnight. And full disclosure, I might get a little snobbish about my limited theater background. So with that said, this was a pretty great movie, a great adaptation. It did miss some things, but in all, we enjoyed it and hope you did too. So here it is, episode 47, Into the Woods and Getting Your Wish. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Yeah, that's right. We haven't started recording. Good call. So, Into the Woods is interesting because I always love watching what people who have no history with it. Like, they haven't seen really the Broadway play, they haven't been in it, they haven't read about it, they haven't watched other adaptations, et cetera, et cetera. And then they go and see something like this. It was similar to when we went to watch Much Ado, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I couldn't remember a lot of the stuff that had happened because it had been so long since I'd seen the play, but, like, I know you were like, I do this play all the time, you know? As a theater teacher, they probably make you read it, like, once a month.
Right,
you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Every Shakespeare. And then, every single month.
That's right. Yeah, every Shakespeare, every single month. That's right. And then Laura is... it's
pretty
like her favorite. It's like her favorite play. So she was, you know, like quoting the entire thing, and you know, so it was interesting to see my perspective on it compared to people who, you know, had a lot more familiarity to it. And so this is like the opposite because even though almost everyone knows what Into the Woods is or what it's roughly what it's about, or you know, they recognize some of the songs occasionally, like not a lot of people have actually seen the whole thing through, unless you have some kind of tie to it. You know, it's not like Romeo and Juliet. You weren't required to read Into the Woods and whatever.
Sure.
It's not like Phantom of the Opera or Les Mis. Like, you know, you can't throw a stone without hitting someone singing a Les Mis song. You know, and you wish you...
At any given time.
Which is good, because lots of times when people are singing Les Mis songs, I want to throw stones at them.
Aww. Actually, I'm very surprised that I didn't know anything about this play, and I'd never heard any of the songs before. And so I was, like, really surprised to find out that it won the Tony
for Phantom,
which I feel like is pretty familiar to people. But, I mean, maybe that's just me. Maybe some people know nothing about the Phantom. But, I had never heard any of this music, and I had no idea what it was about.
Well, that's the thing. I had heard, actually, when I hear a song or something from Phantom, I'm like, oh, I recognize that. And you're like, it's from Phantom. And I'm like, okay, I would have not known that. So, like, I mean, I'm assuming it's probably similar to how people view Into the Woods, except Into the Woods songs are like, Into the Woods, Into the Woods, Into the Woods, Into the Woods. And they're like, oh, is that from Phantom of the Opera? You know, there's not as much disconnect there. But
what about the song from Phantom of the Opera that says, the Phantom of the Opera is here?
Never heard it. Well, so this is, you know, it's an awarded Broadway play. It's done kind of questionably, and we could talk about this at some point.
Really? What is it?
Questionably in high school theaters.
Yeah.
I actually was wondering that when I was in it in high school. I was like, can we be doing this? Like, is this cool? I mean, I know we're a public school and we can do whatever.
Sure.
But there were some themes, like I said, that we'll probably get to. But so, you know, so the
the director, Rob Marshall, was like, hey, we can finally bring this beloved musical to the screen. We have the technology to do this. We have the special effects. It was begging for this thing. And honestly, after Les Mis did so well and was so acclaimed a couple years ago with its Christmas Day release, I think, you know, people are looking for anything that's going to catch that spark. Mm. But the thing is, I never really thought that this is a simple play, but yet the description of it as... or the synopsis being a witch takes a childless baker or tasks a childless baker and his wife with procuring magical items from classic fairy tales to reverse the curse put on their family tree. I was like, oh, I guess that is what it's about, but it's not really what it's about. So this one takes a whole bunch of people that we're really familiar with, pretty famous, you know, Anna Kendrick, James Corden, Emily Blunt, Johnny Depp and his extended cameo as the wolf, Chris Pine, and then some other slightly lesser known people, but you know, familiar if you know, you watched, like I said, Les Mis or things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's taken them and put them together for something that I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. But it, like I said, it still brought back all those questions that I remember asking myself as a high schooler, and I didn't realize how self-aware I was, maybe, or I thought I was as I was high school, because I was like, oh my gosh. Because I remember talking to you, Laura, about it before we went in to the movie. And I was like, some of these songs are kind of sexual. Yeah. And I'm kind of surprised. But, like I said, I've had experience with it. So I'm more interested in hearing what you guys have, what kind of experience you guys had with this movie. Or maybe with the experience you've had before. And so, Ethan, I'm most, unfortunately, Laura, you know, not to slight you. But, Ethan, I'm really interested in hearing kind of like what your experience was with it. What if anything you knew about it coming in, and then how you enjoyed the movie in general, you know, what stuck out to you in this movie?
Well, being a theater teacher, I've heard of Into the Woods a lot because it's a show that people do a lot in high school theater, as you have talked about and kind of alluded to. And I saw a production of it a few years ago with a high school. I can't remember what high school it was, and it was just okay. It wasn't great. It didn't really stand out to me.
So you remember what it was. You just don't want to call them out.
Exactly. I don't want to call them out on this podcast.
High school.
Exactly. Some high school somewhere. And so I was vaguely familiar with the story. And going into it, I just went into it without a whole lot of expectation and really enjoyed it. I thought it was very visually arresting. I enjoyed the actors. I thought they did a really good job with their roles. And I thought a lot of the choices the director made were very interesting choices. And I thought they really helped tell the story really well. So overall, I thought it was a really interesting story. Actually, coming in with very little knowledge of the story, I thought it was really interesting to watch.
Well, so let's take that a step further. How dark or light, like where do the themes fall? Like is this subject matter too heavy for like high schoolers?
Would you?
I mean, because you know you're a theater teacher, so you're teaching high school age kids. Like, mm-hmm. like what do you think it would take for you to? And I know it's a musical, so it's slightly different than what you typically do.
Sure.
But the subject matter wise, like. Is this something that you feel is something that you would ever want to do?
Well, I think you have to look at it with a viewpoint that what you saw on the screen from what research I've done since I watched the movie is not exactly the end of the woods. It's not as far as you could take it. So yeah. I think there was some blunting of the material. The director made some choices, Disney-fied it a little bit, you know, bringing it to the screen. I think myself personally, I mean, I think with the shows that we do, we've done a lot of fairly dark stuff, and we've done Count of Monte Cristo, which is a very mm-hmm. dark story if you look at it. Three Musketeers, if the original is very dark, not the Disney Three Musketeers with the long hair and the all that. So I think, I mean, looking at the story, it's kind of hard for me to say I would do this without really going back to the script and saying this is the way it should be done if I'm being truthful to the original script, mm-hmm. Because I do think that you are seeing an adaptation, and I think that adaptation has merits, but I also think that adaptation did blunt some of the themes mm-hmm. from what I understand of the story.
Mm. I'm also curious to know if, like, when you were watching it, if you thought, I don't know, like, as a theater teacher at a Christian school, when you, like, watch a play or read a play, does your mind immediately go to, like, oh, parents or, like, administration are not going to care for this subject matter, or Like, did any of those red flags come up for you?
Sure. And I think you'll, being somebody who is in charge of material and taking that material and putting it into the public, I think you always have to think about those things. And I think, especially working in a situation where the parents expect something that's a little more wholesome, perhaps, than you could get away with in a public school, you always have to look at that and kind of put that through that that lens. And once again, going back to the movie, I think Rob Marshall made some choices, and he put it also through sort of a filter of this is kind of what I'm going to do. And the filter he put it through was for more of a younger audience, I would say. Once again, not exactly knowing what the original script was, but from what I've looked at, I would think he did that.
Yeah. Well, it seems like they've got a lot of success. And when I say they, I mean, you know, Disney's got a lot of success in kind of making some of these fairy tales either completely kid-friendly or telling you, like, the Maleficent version where it's still hypothetically a little bit scary, but it's accessible to kids. Because I remember when we went to see Maleficent, I expected it to be, like, a very kind of dark and, I don't want to say sad, but tragic kind of experience that might be a little too heavy. You know, but when we went, I was like, wow, you know, they made everything bright and colorful, and they really,
and the character's sympathetic.
Yeah, like, I don't want to say I'm going to say they dumbed it down.
Sure.
I felt like they dumbed down some of the evil parts, or they glossed over them real quick, so that if you took your kid, the kid would probably enjoy it, not get too scared. Because, you know, I want to point out that I'm not trying to hide things from kids. You know, but I think there's a way that you can gate them into certain topics, and there's a certain maturity level that you probably need to be at before you start discussing things like, well, like I said, Maleficent could have easily talked about, like, rape, like sexual abuse, like things like that. Like, there's, you don't want to pretend those things don't exist to kids, but there's a maturity gate that you want to have those conversations honestly with them. And so, I mean, to a certain degree, there's some of that stuff in Into the Woods as well. Some highly, or could have been more sexualized, some songs, some things that were slightly altered, changed situations, decisions that you pointed out, Ethan, that Rob Marshall made to, you know, adapt it in a way that could be kid friendly. But at the same time, I think some of the material, especially, you know, Act Two, in this play, is completely dark, or it starts to be basically completely dark until the very end, and then it's kind of like kind of light.
Yeah,
and it's being so vague right now.
Yeah.
Is this spoiler free?
Well, I was gonna say we will spoil everything. I mean, it's a play that's been out since '87, so you'll.
But you know what I really thought was interesting, knowing some, not all, obviously, of the Grimm's fairy tales. I thought it was interesting that the fairy tales inside of Into the Woods were much truer to the original Grimm's fairy tales than the Disney-fied versions that you see. I mean, you know, you think about the story of Cinderella and how in the original story, I mean, it sticks really closely to the original Grimm story. I mean, she goes out to the woods, her mother's grave is there, she kind of communes with her mother. Then when the sisters try on the shoes, they cut their feet off, they maul themselves so they can fit into the slippers, and then at the end, the birds come down, she calls the birds, and they peck their eyes out. And that's the original Grimm story. Also, if you look at the original Rapunzel story, it's that where the prince is riding away, and the witch puts a curse on him, he follows him, and he pokes his eyes out. So all those things were very true to the original Grimm story, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, and there's been some talk as well that Into the Woods, this film version, is having trouble finding its audience because it's just dark enough that it's going to be over younger children's heads, and it's just light enough that it doesn't really explore some of those themes.
Yeah, I was going to read this quote from the Real Gospel Review that talks about that, and I'm interested to see how you fall on this. But they said that they felt the film struggled to work out who its intended audience is. Clearly, the original musical would have been for adults, but with the movie, it seems to go for the halfway mark. It wants to have a family-friendly look and feel, yet retain the darker themes that made the musical feel so memorable for adults. Thus, there's an edginess to it that doesn't quite fit in with the family-oriented production it seems to be going for. Yeah. At the same time, it doesn't probe quite as deeply into some big existential themes of good and bad.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, too, you know, you can look at a perfect example of that would be in the second act, where you look at the prince meeting the baker's wife and that whole mm-hmm. thing that happens. Obviously, in the original play version, they weren't just kissing. I mean, there was a lot more going on. And then even when she dies, it felt kind of, why didn't you see her body? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. it was kind of an interesting thing of, like, they just showed her, like, her hand up, you know, and then she's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I almost felt like they kind of pulled back on both of those. And
yeah. Yeah.
Why is that?
And they talk about it later.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the things that, like I mentioned earlier, I was trying to brace Laura for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, these songs are fun, but they're some of the most, clever and layered songs that I've ever heard in musicals. Because mm-hmm. most of the musicals that people have gotten me to watch, or that I've watched on my own, are like, hey, I'm this guy, I'm doing this thing, you know? And it's really obvious.
Sure.
You know, like, they're basically just singing what they're doing, you know. It's like Community makes fun of, you know, everyone,
yeah.
you know, says what they, or sing what they mean, and
yeah.
or whatever. But, like, this one is a whole bunch of conflicting people and people trying to work out their emotions through each song. Mm-hmm. And so in the song, you have lots of innuendo, you have lots of callback, and just conflict within the character. So all the turns of phrases are very important. And I feel like you can listen to a song over and over and over and catch something that you didn't. So like I said, I was bracing Laura. I was like, now, like most plays, you know, there's a vision that the director has.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, for where things are going. And so I remember being in a production of this play in high school, my senior year of high school, and then I think my freshman year in college, I went to see the college's production of the play, and I remember going, whoa, those were pretty different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sexualness of some of the songs, especially The Wolf and Little Red Riding Hood, I remember, like, hearing that song on the soundtrack some of the first times, and I was like, you know, especially in high school, a high school, you know, boy, and where his imagination's going anyway, mm-hmm. being like, whoa, that's a little scandalous. You know, we had to dumb that down a lot for our high school play. But, you know, when I saw it at college, they had, you know, it's a liberal school. We're going to, you know, we're going to play that up. And they're, you know, whatever. So same thing with the, you know, the Prince and the Baker's Wife song towards the end.
That song is where I felt the... like the absence of depth more than any other place in the play, really. Because
Wait, which one?
The Baker's Wife.
The Baker's Wife
and Prince.
Yeah.
Because I felt like, I guess I kind of felt like I either wanted her song before she died to show us, like, that redemption. Like, that she says, like, oh man, what I did was so wrong. I need to go back to my life. I'm really remorseful. Or it needed to be in the other direction and say, there's nothing wrong with this, you know. But I felt like that song kind of, like, danced on the edge, and then she was suddenly gone, and there was nothing else for her to do to show that she either knew that what she did was wrong or, you know, was okay with it. And so I kind of felt like what happened then was that whole incident was kind of treated like it was nothing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it's just a moment in the woods.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's an interesting theme that comes up in this play is that, and as she says in her song, she's talking about, you know, we're in the woods, and kind of the woods are almost at fault.
Mm-hmm.
And that theme, I mean, you can trace it back, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. You can trace it back to the god Pan in Greek mythology, you know, how Pan lived in the woods, and the woods are sort of seen as this licentious place. And then you could take it into Shakespeare's time. Like A Midsummer Night's Dream, mm-hmm. they go into the woods and they lose their you know, their minds in a way, and where Puck is kind of messing with them. And so it's that same idea that you come into the woods, where the woods are this place where there's sort of a lawlessness. There's sort of this place where anything can happen. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about with the mm-hmm. song. Is she, you know, it's the woods' fault. It's not my fault.
Yeah,
I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And like, maybe I was supposed to feel that way, but I guess, like, what I really wanted was there to be some redemption, because I liked her character a lot and I liked the dynamic she had with her husband. So I wanted her death to mean something more to me than, like, for her to be gone and come back later and be singing and be this, you know, this great memory in her husband's mind, and to say, like, that's not really who that person was. It didn't seem like that's who that person was. Maybe I was supposed to feel that way because she... I mean, like, maybe because we think that we are better than we are, you know?
Well, I think contrasting her character to the husband's character, and Mikey, you're the authority on this, so correct me if I'm wrong. But
I am the authority on this.
You are, as in all things. But in the original play version, his father's ghost sings with him multiple times. Am I correct?
Yeah, his father's in there. Yeah.
Well, that was kind of strange. I almost felt like why for his father just to appear at the end where he had to make that big life-changing mm-hmm. decision, it seemed strange that he just suddenly appears and you don't see him throughout. I mean, mm-hmm. he's talked about, but you don't see him throughout. And so when his father appears, it's kind of a... I mean, I see why he did it, obviously. It's like this is the moment where he has to change and he has to change his life. But without the father coming multiple times in the play, it seemed a little odd.
Abrupt.
Yeah. So, and that would be one of my criticisms. Like, having been in the play, having seen the play, both the video of the Broadway version... and having seen it a couple times in person, there were things that I wanted to happen in this musical or in this version of it that I just didn't see happen, and it's almost like to me, like once you watch the extended version of Lord of the Rings, it's really really hard to go back and watch the non-extended because you're like all these things that kind of you were like okay, like they were so explained in the extended version. That you can't go back and be like, well, you can't just throw that in there. You got to explain that, you know, because you know. And so the omission of the narrator in the film, this film version, wasn't the greatest tragedy, but there were some pieces of songs or some character pieces that were left out. I'm assuming doing time constraints, you know, because mm-hmm. the regular play. I feel like it's very long. It's one of the longest plays I felt like I've ever either been a part of and or had to watch.
You also have the advantage when you're watching the theatrical version of an intermission, which we didn't have.
Yeah.
Because it did feel long to
me. So, you know, you have that intermission in a theater. Sure. Or, I can call them both theaters.
Yes.
How do you distinguish?
You said call a theater a theater.
A theater?
And then you call the regular one just a theater.
Yes, please do that.
So when I'm at the theater.
Yes.
Theater and theater.
Yeah,
theater.
The theater.
Oh, that's what you do.
So when I'm at the theater.
Poor man's theater.
You have the intermission, so you get the break. And I remember, you know, like, oh man, I actually kind of need to get up and stretch my legs because, mm-hmm. you know, we haven't even got to act two. But then in this version, you know, you're trying to tune it down to a manageable, you know, especially if you are, or you do have the idea that you are going to take semi-younger children, you know, you're going to have them sit through a three and a half hour movie. Mm-hmm. So I understand that they had to do some things, but there were pieces there that knowing what I know, experiencing what I've experienced, that I was very sad not to get. I think there were some characterizations, I think you actually mentioned it right at the beginning that, you know, Rapunzel's prince just takes her away and everyone's happy. I'm like, whoa, there's so like
no one gets a happy ending but them.
Yeah. And I was like, that's not, you know, that's not what it is. Like that you've mischaracterized Rapunzel's prince because you've omitted a song that we kind of get the agony reprise at towards the end of the actual play or the actual musical. And because we got that in that version, when we don't have it here, it looks like maybe only Cinderella's prince, or you know, Chris Pine is the one who's willing to cheat. But actually, it's both those princes who always want what they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you miss that characterization. Yeah, I think you miss some things with the baker's wife, because in Act One she is, and you know, you're incredibly on the baker's wife train. You know, you're like, she's strong, she's been kind of left behind, but they need to be a team, they need to get on the same page, she wants this thing to happen, and you're with them, and then in Act Two, you're like, why did you just do this thing? Mm-hmm. Why do you suddenly care about this other life?
Mm-hmm.
And did you resolve this before your sudden and tragic demise?
Mm-hmm.
And
which, feels bad to me, but is probably more realistic than, like... It's like the whole, like, Walking Dead thing, you know, like, a character's gonna die when suddenly they have a character arc and they're, like, sympathetic. You're like, oh, well, bye. You want them, like, we all want to see that redemption. We want, when someone dies, we want that death to have meant something, and we want to, like, feel like that, unless they're the villain, I guess, we want to feel like they have some value, but you know, we don't all get our, like, heroic moment before we kick it, so.
Well, I also think then the question comes up, why do it? I mean, if you don't do it and you're not doing it to its if you're not telling the story the way the story should be told. And I know Sondheim, I mean, he was quoted as saying that he loved this movie version of it, but if you're leaving out parts that are lacking, that give a incomplete vision of the character, then why do it?
Well, and you mentioned Steven Sondheim is the guy who wrote all the music, and you know he also did Sweeney Todd, and he's got a whole bunch of other really notable, if not mm-hmm. famous, things under his belt. So the fact that he gave it his stamp of approval should have been, you know, huge thumbs up. Mm-hmm. And maybe he does feel that most of the things that he tried to convey were conveyed with some of the songs, like I said, cut in places and not.
I feel like you haven't really said if you liked it or not yet.
But well, I was gonna try to correct my omission because I wanted to know what you thought as well.
Because you say that, like, I know you're disappointed that some things were taken out, but like, did that completely ruin or mislead like the message of the movie? Is what I'm saying. Because I think I felt like I still got the sense. The overall sense that, like, getting what you wish for is not always good, or we always want what we don't have. Like, I still got that, mm-hmm. even if, you know, they had to omit some of that stuff. So, do you feel like it ruined it, or took it in a new direction, or...
No, I think the thing that I felt when I left was, one, man, that is kind of taxing to watch all at once, without a break, but... I guess it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with some of the themes being explored. When you omit some of that stuff, especially some of the things that you omit in Act 2 to speed up Act 2, I thought that, yes, there were obvious themes. There were things that the play was trying to convey, mm-hmm. or in this case, the film was trying to convey about, you know, getting what you ask for. Like, do you really want it? Have you thought about the consequences? Lots of good things that I'm sure we're going to talk about in just a minute. But I don't think it explored those fully enough. Much like your example of, I felt like the baker's wife just kind of, her arc kind of suddenly stopped. Mm-hmm. And she did suddenly die, and that's part of what happens. Mm-hmm. But I think not understanding the seduction angle and the prince's, their motivations for always... wanting things that they don't have.
But that she's not the only one.
Yeah, and she's not the only one. It's not like, you know, what, like I said, there are things there. The at the end, right before the finale, there, like, all the in the theater.
Why don't we just say play and film? That might be easier.
That probably would be.
But it's not near as fun.
It's true.
So in the play, the. All the characters basically come in and they say something they've learned, or, you know, and it's not necessarily a thing that you would want someone to learn. It's you know, it's what that character has learned. So you can kind of see the trajectory that they're on based on the thing that they stick with. You know, all the stepsisters walk out and they say something, and the steward walks out and he says something. You know, so everyone's learned something, and it wraps up a lot nicer. This one seems to almost abruptly end before things are really resolved, or the resolution is jumped too quickly, which I didn't mind. Like, I enjoyed the film. Mm-hmm. It was fun to watch this adaptation be brought to the screen, mm-hmm. With, you know, some things that you can do in film that you can't do in a play or a playhouse. So that was cool, but I felt like it didn't hit as hard as as the original play does, because there's a reason that I tend not to really like musicals in general, but I really like Into the Woods, and it wasn't just because I was in it, mm-hmm. because I think these are some of the most clever and deep songs that I've heard in musicals, and I really, really like that about it. And omitting some of those, or not going deep enough with some of those characters, because I don't think that even in the play, Act 2 resolves itself fully enough. It kind of just points out that everything's a mess. It doesn't actually say, here's a mess, here's how we move on, here's the lesson we learn, because that's what you expect in most things. Something bad happens, the characters learn a lesson, they use that knowledge to then turn their life around or put themselves on a trajectory that you understand, and that's how the story is told. And this one, even in the play, something bad happens. They kind of learn a lesson, But then some of them choose to use that and some of them don't. So you still feel unresolved, but this felt even, the film felt even more unresolved than the play does. So, like I said, all that to say, I enjoyed it, but just like watching the extended versions of Lord of the Rings, it's hard for me to watch it and not all be there because I always feel like I'm missing something. And I want to be like, no, I know you enjoyed this, but it would be even better if.
Yeah.
Or, hey, I mean, lots of the reviewers, I mean, like, I think this is sitting around 50% on Rotten Tomatoes. And that seems about right to me because I think people who know, like, they can fill in the blanks, that they're going to enjoy it. I think people who are coming to it kind of flat, they're going to not pick up on everything, or they're going to be like, well, it's okay, you know?
Well, okay, so I didn't have any other context for watching this, but I did feel some of what you're saying, that, like, I wanted to feel depth in certain areas where I felt like, oh, that's all I'm getting, or maybe I'm not really clear what people learned or what the takeaway is at the very end. But I didn't necessarily leave saying, like, oh, there were big gaps. I don't really know what was going on.
Because
so,
you don't know what the gaps are.
That's true. But, no. So, I mean, like, there are obviously a lot of things, that decisions that people have to make when they're taking a play, especially a musical, and putting it on the screen. And, I'm, like, as you're talking, I'm thinking about how, like, in a musical, I feel like a lot of, like, the message, a lot of the tone, the emotion is told through the music. And so when you're doing it in a film, you, like, you have to take time to do a lot of, like, visual things or, like acting that transitions between songs or whatever. And so maybe you lose time that you could put towards music. So you're going to lose some of that anyway. But the songs are so good and were so well performed in this film by these actors that, like, when we were listening to the score last night, just, like, listening to some of the songs, I was like, you know what? I thought maybe I wouldn't want to go see this movie again, but, like, I want to see that song performed again, like, as it was in the film. And so I think I actually would watch it again. So I really enjoyed it. And I think that it wasn't, for me, it wasn't missing a lot. I mean, I didn't notice that it was missing a lot, it, like, the way that you did.
I felt like I really enjoyed it as well. I mean, I really enjoyed the visuals in it. I think one thing I was confused about, and I still, as I think about it, it really stands out to me. I felt in the first half of the movie, when you see Johnny Depp, who I really enjoyed, I felt like his costuming was very theatrical. I mean, I feel like he's obviously not a CGI wolf. Like, he doesn't have these huge appliques on his face. He just has painted whiskers on, which I really thought was nice. I felt like it was a nod to the theatrical version, the play version of it. And then even when he's cut open, I feel like that was a very theatrical way to do it. I mean, it was with silk. I mean, I feel like that's something you would probably have done on a high school stage, which I thought was neat. But then, like, as it moved on, I felt like they used the CGI and they didn't use it very well. Is what I didn't care for the beanstalk that much. I mean, I felt like you could have, because you never saw him up in the sky, why not just, I mean, maybe show, like, have a real, you build part of a real beanstalk and see him going up it. Why do you need to show it going up into the sky?
Just be consistent with the style.
Exactly. Yeah, I felt like it was kind of mixed up. And then even with the giant at the end, did you need to see her big head? Possibly, I guess you sort of did, to see her get hit with the stone and fall down. But I felt like that those two aspects really clashed with the Johnny Depp thing. And I also with some other choices that were made throughout the movie to make it more theatrical. I felt like it could have went further with that instead of kind of trying to blend the CGI with this kind of theatrical way of doing things.
Well, yeah, I would say it did try to live in both worlds. And I'm not sure if that was actually the best choice. But at the same time, it's been noted that the director kind of didn't do anything outrageous. You know, he didn't make it incredibly stylistic. He basically, for the most part, brought the play to film and used some things sparingly, because he could have used a lot more CGI, but, you know, he actually shot, like, on location. He didn't, like, make up everything. But at the same time, I do wonder, because I remember that being one of the interviewed selling points, you know, like, you know, people have seen Into the Woods like 100 times in, you know, in theaters, and they've never really, like, seen Jack climbing up the beanstalk. I'm like, do we really need that? I mean, you're not going to watch him, like you said, you're not going to watch him running around the giant's land. You know, do you really need to see the stone hit? I mean, like, the play has been performed for tons of times, and you know they do the slingshot, and then you just hear it off stage, mm-hmm. and then you know everyone reacts to it, which is actually kind of cool.
Yeah, so, and in keeping with like the with it being a fairy tale, you know that there are fantastical elements that we have to imagine because they're mm-hmm. not real.
You don't have to imagine anything in a film because of magic. Hollywood magic.
That's true. That's
so, true. Well, I like something that I want to go back to, circle around back to something that you had mentioned earlier, Ethan. You talked about like the role of the woods mm-hmm. in, you know, in literature and mm-hmm. theater. Mm-hmm. And I love that basically every character goes into the woods literally, and then they all have like this figurative woods that they're like they're all working themselves through. Like everyone has something in their life that is like causing them to
be confused or misdirected or whatever.
Pain, mm-hmm. like you know, circumstance, or just like not knowing what they want. And I actually struggle with like thinking about how to talk about this on the show because I was like, do we go through every single character and like because every character has like their own mm-hmm. their own thing. But I don't think we necessarily have to do that. But we you know, we might, who knows. Get on certain characters, but I thought it was interesting that everyone was like, I think my life is this way, and if I get this thing, it'll be better. And because of the way you described the woods, that journey always goes through something that they didn't predict.
Mm-hmm. I think I really resonate with that theme, and I think maybe that's why I love the song You're Not Alone so much. Like, that's probably one of my favorite songs, especially the way that it was performed with, like, the boys singing and the girls singing separately. Because, you know, there's this theme that, like, the decisions you make don't just affect yourself, that, you know, and we see that a lot in the Blame song, which is called, what's it called? It's Your Fault.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, everybody's decisions have in some way caused, you know, the mess that everybody's in. But I love the fact that they come to this place where they're able to say, okay, so we're not alone, and are like, we're so in this together that our decisions affect each other, and that could be a bad thing, but it can also be a good thing too, that we're on each other's side, that, you know, the woods are always going to be there, we're always going to have like life circumstances that are hard to navigate, but we're not alone, we're never alone. And I think that's important too, because two of the characters, well, actually three of the characters, no, all four. Of the characters, all of the characters are parentless, so that was cool to see, I think, that little, like, unconventional family form at the end to say, like, we all have loss, this has been a tragedy, but, like, we still have community, we can still navigate this together.
And I think in that, before we, if you want to get in and talk to all the characters individually, I enjoyed that as well. I enjoyed seeing that kind of happen at the end. I think the one thing I could have done without, I felt like that as things were coming together at the end, that the moral was didn't need to be as heavy-handed as they made it at the end, mm-hmm. which was, you know, you got to decide what's good for you. You know, right. You have to decide that. I don't think you needed that. I mean, mm-hmm. I felt like Thornton Wilder has this great quote as a playwright, and his quote is, in matters where logic doesn't operate, beauty is the only persuasion. I felt like beauty in this case could have really sold the moral, instead of having to have that moment at the end where they kind of take the moral and turn it into a stick and beat you over the head with repeatedly. Why do that? I mean, I get it. I get what the moral is. I understand what the focal point of the story is. Leave it with that mm-hmm. instead of bringing it out like the way they did. Yeah. I didn't enjoy that part of it.
Oh, I totally felt that in Children Will Listen at the very end when mm-hmm. they were. I was like. They were like singing this metaphor about like children and dreams, and they were like explaining it, and I was like, this just feels so obvious. I feel like you're treating me like an idiot right now. But I mean, that's like the song, that's not the film that was making that choice necessarily.
And one more quote I thought was made me think about this to show how brilliant I am. George MacDonald, who was a big inspiration for C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, actually, he has this essay he wrote called The Fantastic Imagination. And in The Fantastic Imagination, he's talking about fairy tales. And he says, a fairy tale is not an allegory. There may be allegory in it, but it is not an allegory. He must be an artist indeed who can, in any mode, produce a strict allegory that is not a weariness to the spirit.
Hmm.
Which I kind of felt like that. I felt like, you know, you put this whole thing together, and as I just said, and Laura, as kind of you're saying, like, it comes together and you really get it, but then do you have to make it so heavy-handed is kind of what I'm saying at the end.
Yeah, can you just allow me to feel the beauty of that?
Yeah.
Like, that natural... yeah, like that, like naturally humans will tend together or tend to help each other or whatever. Can you just let me feel that, or do you have to explain it to me too?
You can't, because it's not the way things work. Humans don't naturally feel that.
Well, I mean, that's true. We can argue, like, what is that thing that draws us towards love or towards compassion or whatever. You know, I do feel like the song You're Not Alone gives a lot of... like puts a lot of the onus on the person to make that choice and says that it's from your strength, it's from your goodness that you choose to do whatever. Even though we've seen throughout the entire play that like sin is what pretty much directs people's actions.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be something greater than the individual that causes them to do good. You know, to want to save Jack's life when giving him to the giant could save everybody.
Yeah, really epitomized in the baker, I think, right? I mean, the baker has that choice. He can run off just like his dad did, but he turns around and he comes back to be a part of this family and to lead. And I think going along with what you're saying, I mean, that's... I get that. I mean, I get that from the movie, so...
And maybe that's where some of the depth is lost, is that it doesn't logically make sense that these characters that we've seen make a lot of bad choices from a lot of bad motivations, just suddenly they're able to make a turn on their own. I mean... without any other explanation, I mean, that doesn't really make sense. But
well, and that's part of what I wanted to see maybe played out better in both the play and the film, because I think you have characters, they have motivations, and even if the motivation is good at the beginning to go into the woods, usually the methods once they're in the woods are not. I mean, because I think I want to say most of the motivations are petty or selfish. I mean, I think about the princes going into the woods, you know, following people into the woods. I think about the witch, you know, I think it's pretty selfish of her. I think Red Riding Hood is naive and selfish and, you know, a glutton.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have a whole bunch of these sins represented. I mean, even Cinderella, who in the Cinderella story is fairly empathetic, like, and this one is basically presented as someone who just wants to go to the festival. I'm like, you don't want to not be like a slave in your own house. You just want to go to the festival. Mm-hmm. You just want to go to a party. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, that seems kind of petty. Like, you could ask your fairy godmother for one wish,
mm-hmm.
and it's to go to a party. Like, that's the most teenager wish ever. You know? And so,
but then you have characters that have motivations that I feel like we can get on board with, like wanting to have a child,
or you know, redeeming
a friend. Jack just wants his friend.
Yeah, you know, redeeming your family or having to, you know, make money to keep surviving. Like, mm-hmm. these are fairly noble things. But once you get into the woods, like, these things become, like I said, the baker and his wife hypothetically have noble goals,
mm-hmm.
but the means to that end is oftentimes, maybe ruthless seems harsh, but honestly, they're basically tricking people and or stealing.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, they pretend they have qualms with it, but ultimately what they want is more important.
And I do think you see the baker's wife making a switch. Like, she's kind of this, like, kind, like, motherly, supportive character, but then she starts to, like, I don't know, some of that, like, competitiveness or whatever starts to come out of her as she's... trying to reach the goal.
And I think when you get to Act 2, it's interesting, too, the things that they got are all the things that are getting in their way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the baby is just sort of passed around. It's like, oh, we got this baby. We got to do something with it.
Yeah.
Somebody take it. You take it. You take it. You take it. Obviously, the prince is somebody. It's like, you know, his wife is sort of in the way now of him being able to fulfill his manly desires. And so I think that's an interesting thing that comes up in the second half. Just
well, and that's part of the thing that I really thought was, I guess, clever about this film and or the play, either one, that is that when, you know, people ask for these things, and I think that's where I resonated with it, especially when I was in high school, which is why I was wondering how I was so self-aware. Like, all these things that, like, you ask for or you think are the most important thing, or, like, once we get this, then, you know, blank, blank, blank. it will be okay, or mm-hmm. we will survive. Like, if only we had a baby, then we'd be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, if only I could catch Cinderella and marry her, I would finally be fulfilled as a prince. You know, like things like that. Or if we only could sell the cow and get, you know, get some money, then we'd be okay again. Mm-hmm. You know, like these things that this is the answer. This is what's going to fulfill us or sustain us. Mm-hmm. Like that to me is a theme that I don't understand how anyone could not resonate with.
Sure.
Because, I mean, that's basically our lives every day. You know, if I just keep working this job, then eventually I'll make enough money to retire, and then I'll be happy. You know, the things we put ourselves through, if only I could have a kid, then I'd be happy. If only I got the promotion, then I'd be happy. You know, if only so-and-so was my friend, then we'd have the best time ever. You know, only I could go to that party, mm-hmm. then I would be so
happy.
The
Fessel's New Year's Eve party.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly.
If only, Ethan.
If only. Well, you know, I think that theme, then, you know, you look at another person, another director who is esteemed by all three of us, and Joss Whedon. I mean, mm-hmm. that is what Joss Whedon does to brilliant perfection, I think. I mean, he takes characters, he puts them in a situation, he gives them what they want, and then things blow apart, mm-hmm. you know, on a pretty regular basis. And I think that's what you see in this mm-hmm. play as well.
It's such an interesting theme, I think, to be on the big screen, because to me, like, okay, so as a Christian, that takes me to a place that, like, where I would say, obviously, I can't do this on my own. I need something bigger than myself to change my attitude, to give me fulfillment that I can't find in anything else that I think will fulfill me. So what? Where does this film land? Like, what is that greater thing? Is it just love? I feel that's what the film is saying, because it's not saying that it's some divine being, you know. So,
well, it's interesting because I feel like it almost says, or the film presents itself in an incomplete way, which is one of my qualms with it, especially the film version. It almost says people desire things and they get those things, and then those things, like Ethan's pointing out, become the thing that's in the way, mm-hmm. and then they realize they just need kind of people. Or love, you know, like right. what they need is each other, not a thing. But at the same time, it's not necessarily each other, because some people get other people.
Yeah.
You know, they get their wives or whatnot, or they get their hookup in the woods. I mean, sure. their moment in the woods.
Yes.
You know, and
just a moment.
And those things still don't necessarily fulfill. So I think the Into the Woods is kind of wishy-washy on this, mm-hmm. whereas I think that's still an idea that we take into real life. Like I said, as Christians, like mm-hmm. what would we say is what you really need? And to me, like, it's, I love Tim Keller so much, mm-hmm. Because I think he's fairly wise, and you know, he has a quote in one of his books that says that many people have noted it before me, but they realize that all you need is Jesus, but you don't realize that till it's all you have. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think that we're going to keep striving for things, and we're going to keep striving for things, and where our answer is not wishy-washy, but it always feels wishy-washy, because lots of times, you know, having, like, a spiritual comfort or something like that isn't a tangible thing. Mm-hmm. And so these people find love, I put love in quote marks, you know, at the end. And I think that is kind of supposed to be what it is. You know, mm-hmm. you find community, found community that does fulfill those things that you need more than the thing that you wanted. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like I said, I think the film almost self-contradicts before then.
Yeah. Well, like, it kind of sounds like you're saying that you feel like it could have been more resolved, like, if it went in the direction of the original play. But I guess what I'm saying is there any way that it could have, that it could actually feel conclusive or have closure? Because it feels like it doesn't come to a place that is actually final. Like, that's not the bottom of the pit. It keeps going down.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, even in the play, I feel like they,
okay.
I feel like they do it, I feel like they resolve some of the things better, but ultimately the answer is still incomplete.
Right.
So one of my problems with Into the Woods in any form is that it almost doesn't make a conclusion, mm-hmm. or the conclusion that you could argue it does make about what people need to eventually come together or be happy or at least be satisfied if nothing else, still feels incomplete,
right.
because of the inconsistent message throughout about what people wanted or how they got it, and not really addressing lots of those problems. I mean, they do kind of address it with the Your Fault song that leads into Last Midnight. You know, like, everyone's blaming someone, which is another great thing that we could talk about, how is saturated in our culture. Every time something bad happens, you know, the first thing on the news is, it was his fault, or it was these people because they allowed him to have the guns, or it's the government's fault because they have rules that people can have guns, or it's, you know, it's Steve's fault because Steve punched him once in high school, or, you know, like, everything is some, like, we have to blame someone, and we never look at ourselves. And so I love the fact that eventually they all kind of have to take a little bit of responsibility, but it's never really stated.
Yeah.
Which is where the incomplete part comes for me, because they kind of, not necessarily live happily ever after, but they live ever after, you know? And
so, maybe that kind of comes back to what you were saying, Ethan, about, like, beating us over the head with a moral. I mean, that's what fairy tales typically do, is they, like, come to a moral at the end. Maybe what could have felt more effective is if, as some films do, you just identify a problem. You don't try to answer that question. You just say, look, this is what we think, you know, will bring us happiness, but it doesn't actually happen, you know? Like, I love that shift from Act 1 to Act 2 where everyone's clapping and they're holding their baby and they're looking at the princes and princesses, and then suddenly, like, you know, the other shoe drops. Like, literally, there's a giant stepping on their village. So, so maybe, like, the problem is what we're saying, is that there's really no conclusion that you can offer. But the thing maybe that we all love about this play that resonates with us is that it's identifying a problem that we don't really talk about. And maybe that's enough. It doesn't need to answer the question because it doesn't really have an answer.
Well, I think going back to even, you know, the idea of the woods, I think a question that would come up, and we've kind of already talked about it a little bit, is, you know, these characters are in the woods. And being in the woods gives you an ability to not really make these big decisions, or gives you an ability to kind of be wishy-washy because you're in the woods. And it's like, you know, the characters, when all this stuff starts to happen, they run to the woods because that woods is that place of where the paths are destroyed. I mean, it's just this sort of lawless place again. And so it's also sort of a place where your morals are kind of out the window, you know? So, I don't know, just that idea of, like, that metaphor of in the woods is an interesting metaphor again of, you know, this place where anything can happen. We don't have to make decisions that, you know, we don't have to make these big decisions. We don't have to give you a moral because we're in the woods. We're all in the woods. Who knows? Who knows what's right, what's wrong?
Right, yeah.
Well, that's that's kind of what is interesting really to me, because is it cool that no one has to make these decisions? Or, I mean, is the film even saying, like, hey, it's cool that you make mistakes, just move on from them? And, like, I like that about it, but at the same time, I really don't like it about it, because I do want it to have a conclusion. I want it to say, like, this is the thing. Or don't pretend to answer the question when you don't really answer the question, because, like you pointed out earlier, Laura, I'm okay with movies just being like, hey, all we wanted to let you know of is that there's a problem. There's a problem. Boom. Deal with it. You know? Or, hey, here's a problem. Here's our method to resolution. And this movie kind of falls somewhere in between. But it, like I said, I love the fact that even though I don't necessarily think that its conclusion wraps up, I can't watch this film and I can't listen to the you know, the music, whatever form I ended up watching it in, and not think about how personally I'm always, like, asking for things or wishing for things that I don't really think through the consequences of getting. And usually, like I said, we don't usually think of wishes and consequences. We used to think of wishes and happiness and mistakes and consequences. And so the fact that this puts in our mind that a wish could be a mistake. And this, I love the fact that it doesn't seem like they learned their lesson, because at the end, the very last line of the film is, I wish, you know, and Cinderella says it again. And I'm like, you know, you're like, no, you didn't learn. You know, like, you always want something you don't have, which, again, we would see through the princes more if they added the second prince song. But we kind of see that anyway. So it reminds me of another Tim Keller quote when I think about it. when he says that God will only give you what you would have asked for if you knew everything he knows.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes me self-reflect a lot on what I want and why I want it. Mm-hmm. Because it would be great. I'm like, man, I wish I just won the lottery. You know, but different set of problems, different set of things that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because money can do, can turn people a lot of different ways. So the, you know, you think, oh, if I only had that house, or if I only lived in this piece, I would be happier. You know, oh, I wish I had their problems. Mm-hmm. You know, I could deal with that. But, you know, the understanding is hopefully that we are exactly in the place that we need to be.
Mm-hmm.
For what we're doing.
Yeah. And I think just coming off the Christmas season, I mean, that's something we all go through, right? I mean, we kind of are looking for these gifts. And then if we look at the gospel message, you know, that's what the people of Israel were wanting. They're wanting a king to come and rescue them from slavery. And then God sent them a baby. And, you know, through the whole...
This is
what we wanted. Through the whole of Jesus' life, you know, that they were all confused of, who's this guy? I mean, yeah. We wanted somebody to kick the Romans out. We don't want this guy coming around telling us all these things, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's the neat way that God operates. You know, we want these tangible things that we think will give us happiness and joy. And all throughout the Gospels and the whole Bible, you see God giving people these things and these hints and these leadings on to something that's going to be the real thing that they need, hmm. opposed to the things they want.
So you think if we recast kind of Into the Woods with like the disciples and stuff, do you think like Peter would be Cinderella? You know, he'd want the most like trivial thing.
Oh yeah.
And then
yeah.
at the end he would still be like, I wish.
Yes.
And you'd be like, you just didn't get it at all, Peter. You know? You're still obviously going to be the cornerstone of what's coming,
yeah.
but you still don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I really like how this like murky, mysterious forest, like lawless place, every character enters into it like cheerfully singing, saying like, the path is clear and they're just trees and like, you know, nothing could go wrong. Everything, mm-hmm. you know, they enter lightly saying like, I can navigate this. But things very quickly shift, become unclear or dangerous. So that's just like one of the things. I mean, that is the thing that this story does so well. I think that I've said before is why it resonates, why I like it so much, is that it takes all these things that we expect to go one way and shifts them, turns them on their head, and in a really interesting way that illuminates a very real truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that through, I mean, the songs are incredibly clever. I mean, the way that the story shifts is really clever. Mm-hmm. I think it's really well done in that way.
Well, doing it, throwing out another George MacDonald quote, he says, answering this question, because he's kind of answering a series of questions in this essay he writes, he has this question. You write as if a fairy tale were a thing of importance, must it have a meaning? And his answer to that is, it cannot help having some meaning. If it have proportion and harmony, it has vitality, and vitality is truth. The beauty may be plainer in it than the truth, but without the truth, the beauty could not be, and the fairy tale would give no delight. And I think that kind of is everything we're talking about. I mean, there's truth in it, and it's a beautiful thing to look at, mm-hmm. As far as visually arresting the movie is, but without that truth undergirding all that beauty, it wouldn't be as interesting to watch, or it wouldn't be as interesting to talk about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe I feel like I really liked the first half of this play, like the first
mm-hmm.
act.
Mm-hmm.
I was completely in it. I got a little bit, I felt like the second act was dragging a little bit, and I knew what they were doing, but maybe it wasn't as clear, the truth wasn't as clear in the second half as it was in the first half. And I know that like the first half would say something completely different if it ended there. So I know that you can't have it on its own, but the truth felt a little bit clearer to me in that half. And I still was getting the sense that like, oh, these characters are striving for something that could destroy them. You know, it wasn't, that theme was still evident in the first half. So that's interesting. I feel like the balance between beauty and truth was really clear in the first half, and I enjoyed it more than the second.
Hmm.
Well, I thought, you know, especially talking about specific characters, I felt like Meryl Streep's character of the witch was really compelling and very
mm-hmm.
interesting. And I think her desire was really beautifully acted out. I mean, to protect this girl who had become her daughter and protect her from the, she's got that beautiful song. She talks about all the things that are in the world, and there's also, as well as beautiful things, there's also awful things too. And I think being a parent, that really resonates with me, that you, I want to give my daughters all these things, but at the same time, all these things will hurt them, and I know it'll hurt them. And she's having that struggle in herself to try to protect her daughter, and I think that's a really compelling idea and thing that is brought up in the movie.
Even though she's going about it all the wrong way. Actually, I probably wouldn't fault you in this day and age if you take your two daughters and you lock them in a tower.
I'm building it right now. If you could help me, that'd be great. It's a big, very tall.
No haircuts for these girls.
No haircuts. Yeah.
Just having Ethan scaling the side.
That's right.
You know, and that's a cool thing too, is that like, I think we have a lot of those characters in like today's storytelling that their motivations are like some good and some bad. They're very gray. They're not, you know, black and white like maybe some of the early storytelling was. That you can, like, you can resonate with a character because you see good in there as well as the bad, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for most of these characters, is that, I mean, like, Red Riding Hood is a brat, but she loves her grandma, and she, like, was going to visit her grandmother, and she wanted to save her grandmother, and so I think they all have kind of a mixture of good and bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we start to wind down, because I think that was a good place to stop-ish at, let's reflect on the pieces of the film that resonated and didn't resonate with us. And we usually do that through our come on moments and our favorite moments. So we start with the bad so we can end with the good. The opposite of Into the Woods. And what was some part, some character, some theme, something in the movie that just kind of made you either roll your eyes or just didn't settle well with you? Where did you land in that, Ethan?
I think the heavy-handed moral at the end. I think you got to find truth in yourself. You got to find joy in yourself. As I said before, I just don't think you needed it. I think that the film, even the film with all of its flaws, it told its story well enough that I could glean what it was trying to give to me through the storytelling, and I didn't need that at the end. You know, I think any fairly intelligent person could get it, and I don't think you need that sort of shoved down your throat in the end. And that was the part I was like, come on, just let me just listen to the story and let me finish it out.
Maybe another problem with the unsure audience. See, it's true. I hit things and make noise. Because maybe a child would need that in a place that an adult wouldn't, you know? So kind of just decide what you want to do. Yeah.
So, Laura, what was...
I mean, I still am a little bit stuck on the Baker's Wife's last song. Like, just the way that she ended. And, like, even her death felt like ambiguous. Like, wait, did she die? Oh, she's gone. Okay. And, again, like, a lot... Maybe that is completely a choice made for... Because you're supposed to feel that way. I don't know. But I just wanted more from her, and I wanted that to be less innocuous and ambiguous. And
so you stand with most males in America and are sad to see Emily Blunt die.
I'm talking about the Baker's Wife, not
Emily
Blunt.
Yes, I'm sure. Wink, wink, nod, nod.
So, I mean, that's the only part I can think of that I was really like, what?
So I think most of my, I don't want to say disappointment, maybe that's too harsh, that most of where I landed in the dislike was the omission. Because honestly, the first Prince song is probably going to be most people, like, one of the highlights for most people. Mm-hmm. But to me, the second Prince's song is infinitely more hilarious, not only because it shows the continuing character of the princes, but because it basically takes the first song and makes every piece of the first song even funnier. So without that prince, the Prince's song reprise being in the film, I felt like they missed a pretty good opportunity to characterize both the princes, mm-hmm. and just a great moment from the actual play. So, and I'll make sure I put, I found soundtracks on YouTube for the 2014 film, and there was a playlist of the 1987 or 88, I can't remember which one they recorded, the Broadway play, that soundtrack. I found both those on YouTube, so I'll make sure I link those. So if you are curious, the difference in some of the songs, if you're curious in some of the songs they left out or they altered slightly, then you can listen to both of those, because like I said, the music was really good, but the some of those omissions really, just like the extended editions, it's hard to go back and watch mm-hmm. without it in it. Outside of that, I think as a critique of the whole play, or the whole film, is as much as I like the witch's character, and I've seen some really great performances of the witch, I really like her songs the least.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're some of the most important songs, and for whatever reason, I just don't like them stylistically.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're all big, they're very big and over the top.
Yeah,
all
those songs, but most of them are really fast and
yeah.
I don't know. It's just a style thing. Like, I'm not saying they're technically bad songs mm-hmm. or they're unimportant.
And Meryl Streep killed it.
Yeah,
she really did.
I thought she did a pretty great job.
Did they CGI her face to make her look younger?
To look younger?
That, I was always wondering that the whole second half.
There could have been a lot of makeup involved.
Honestly thought, and I said this to Laura, when they were making her, they were going to transform her into her young, beautiful self, mm-hmm. I was like, I think they're really going to recast since they didn't use any makeup for the witch. I wish I liked them more, but I didn't, and I like most of the music in this play or this film so much that they really stand out to me stylistically. But they're still fairly clever, and they're still vastly important. So I would not remove them. But so we end on a positive note,
mm-hmm.
very positive, because we all seem to enjoy this. Ethan, what was your favorite moment or moments from this film?
I think that one of my favorite moments was when the baker turned around and went back to help the crew there defeat the giant. I mean, I feel like that's that moment that you look for in so many films and so many TV shows, where the hero finally decides he's going to be the hero, and he turns mm-hmm. around and he goes back into the fray, and I really enjoyed that a lot. I also, of course, enjoyed the princess song. I thought it was hilarious. But I think those were probably two of my favorite moments. I like the theatricality of the Johnny Depp appearance. I thought he was really fun, and I thought that whole sequence was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Maura?
I just was really impressed with the whole cast. Like, I think they really brought something to this that is probably different from a lot of theatrical or play performances. They're really seasoned actors, but they also, I mean, that's obviously their strong suit, but they were really musically on point. So I thought it was really well cast, and I especially really liked Little Red Riding Hood and Jack. They were so good. And I liked Jack and Les Mis too. He played Gavroche, and mm-hmm. I was glad to see him again. I really liked this song. I've already mentioned it. What's it called? No One Is Alone. That one stood out to me. And, of course, the Princess song was awesome, especially when... I don't think I laughed louder in any part of the movie than when they, Was it Chris Pine, opened his shirt first, and then the other prince...
was like, oh, it's not opening up. That growing competition between them. I mean, and you realize, their whole motivation is, competition and getting...
They did so well,
mm-hmm.
Individually and together.
Yeah. It's such a great place for people to shine in that movie. I think if you get cast as the prince in Into the Woods, or either the princes in Into the Woods, you get to bring your A game,
mm-hmm.
And you get to do some really funny stuff, and
You know, and I thought about how, like, when we saw the preview for this movie and we saw, like, the spots they gave to Chris Pine in the preview, and he was just, like, always his chest was out and he was, like, so dramatic. And we were kind of like, huh, that's, you know, funny and over the top. But it completely worked. Like, he had to be that way, and he did it the whole time. It was great.
What was one of the quotes I read? And I'm not going to quote it exactly, but it... one reviewer said, I've never really understood the likeness of Chris Pine and William Shatner until I saw Into the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite moment was the Princess song. It's one of my favorite songs, like I said, because the Princess Reprise is probably my favorite song, which I don't know if I mentioned this, but it wasn't in the film.
Yeah, I think you may have mentioned it once in passing.
Not?
But I like the music a lot. Like, everyone is talking about how Meryl Streep killed it, and I thought she did a really good job, but I'm going to be one of those, like, you know, old school people and be like, well, I think Bernadette Peters killed it in the original, so I'm gonna stick, you know, if I only have one vote, I still vote for Bernadette Peters over Meryl Streep, though. Like I said, she did a fine job. I really liked the casting. I thought it was fun to watch. I was wanting to sing along at times. I may have been in the theater, so I thought it worked really well. And in general, I think my favorite part was that it was fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you can go into a musical and it can just be something that you do. Like, the songs aren't super engaging; they're not super memorable. I mean, lots of the Disney films that I've seen that have music in them, like, I watch them and I come away and I don't remember lots of the songs,
mm-hmm.
but I can't not remember most of the songs from this. So maybe they need to get him to write more, you know, Disney musicals that are not for children, because thematically he might be a little over the top. But okay, so I want to give you guys a chance, one last chance. Just your final thoughts. You know, anything that we didn't cover, anything that you think needs to be said that may not have been said, I get your recommendation, you know, things like that.
I would definitely go see it. I think it's very entertaining. I was about to say, I don't know if I would take children to it, but I guess kind of depending on the child and depending on the level of conversation you want to have with them afterwards, you could. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was good to go watch. There are obviously some flaws in it, but I thought it was very entertaining.
Nice.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I haven't said was that I noticed that the baker and his wife actually were, like, parental, whether they had their own child or not. You know, like, they took care of Red. They, just the way that the baker was with Jack. And so, anyway, that just, like, highlighted for me, like, a message that I felt like I was getting from the film, which is that, like, look at what you have. Look at, like, how you're able to accomplish what you want to, even if you don't, like, have the tools that you want, maybe. Mm-hmm. That, like, maybe you actually are fulfilling your dream or reaching goals. It's just a different path for you. And so that was something that I felt, like, a message that I felt coming to me that was impactful. But I think I've said everything else.
Everything. I will never hear Laura say anything about this movie ever again. I thought it was fun. I thought it was worth experiencing. Hopefully it'll get people to want to go back and do like I did in high school and listen to the End of the Woods soundtrack while you're driving down the street, because it's the coolest thing and hippest thing to listen to.
Pulling your shirt up.
Yeah, pulling your shirt up. Yeah, as you drive.
It's so cool to be a theater nerd.
Yeah. And if you're not, I know a great place where you can go to be a theater nerd.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Of any age.
Yes.
Not any age, probably.
No, not any age.
I would say it's fun. It doesn't drive home some of the things that I think I would like it to. And it does have a little bit of an issue finding its audience. I think that's a valid complaint. But unless you're going for Oscar drama type levels of stuff, I think you'll enjoy it on some mm-hmm. level. So I can't watch this play without having a great conversation about our desires and what we want in life and what happens if we actually got that and what will we do next.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what actually fulfills it.
Yeah, what actually fulfills us, what should fulfill us, things like that. So I think it's a great movie to watch with people and talk. and self-reflect about, you know, what you wish for in your own life and why you wish for it and if you should wish for it. So I would commend it on those notes. And I guess close by saying thanks to my guests for being here to talk about it. This is the first time we've had Ethan on, and I've been trying to find a way to get him in for a while.
Thank you for having me.
It was awesome. So if people have enjoyed what you say, and I'm sure they have because they are probably tired of listening to me, well, I'm going to keep talking right now.
Yes.
how can people see what you do, follow you, or can keep the conversation going, Ethan?
For
any way, like, is there any way to get a hold of you? I know you're really great at responding to texts and emails.
I'm really good at it.
Such a communicator.
Hey, you know, we do shows at Caldwell Academy, which is a private school here in Greensboro. So we're doing Pinocchio. It's coming up at the end of February. And then we're doing You Can't Take It With You, which is a comedy that just about every high school does at some point. So that is in the end of April. And I'm also doing a theatrical outreach program called Theater 626, which is getting ready to get ramped up in a different way this coming year. So more will be out about that.
Can you find those things on the interwebs?
Yeah, is there like a place for Theater 626?
There is. It's at Theater 626 at Squarespace. Squarespace.com is where our website, Theater 626 at Squarespace.
Nice.
And more announcements will be coming.
That's nice to know.
All right, Laura, how can people find what you do and find you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Laura_Fissel or go to my website at laurafissel.com.
Best ways to get a hold of you.
Yep.
All right. Well, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. Where you find me on Facebook. Lots of you find me on Facebook. I'm kind of okay with that. I'll friend everybody in the world. You can follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter to see when we post new stuff, new shows, new articles, things of interest. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L worldtheology.com. Hopefully you've already found it. That's where you found the show and or other things. And we post show notes there. Connect with us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, please review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. So again, like I said, I thank my guests. Thank you, Ethan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being here so much. And I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.
Be careful what you wish for.
I wish. This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
I like that you have to do that in the Cinderella voice.
Yes.
Because, like, she's not the only character who's saying that, but you have to sing it like Cinderella.
Can I use your bathrooms?
Yeah.
Because I'm in agony. Is that it?